But you recall that the last time we met, we were discussing, for those whose memory is short, we've been studying the section in the Rambam that deals with the basic fundamentals of Jewish philosophy. First of all, the problem of how a person can correct things that he did wrong or she did wrong, and he leads in from there into the whole fundamental discussion of what is right and wrong, and includes reward and punishment, more serious things a person can do wrong, less serious, some things are harder to fix up, others are easier, and it leads to, this discussion continues to cover all the basic philosophical areas of Judaism, including free will, acquiring the next world, the positive side of the next world, the negative side, and that's why we chose this section. Now, the subsection that we were doing last was the following thing. Rambam said, just to remind you, that there are ways that we judge, a person is judged. There's a balancing up of positive and negative actions that a person has done, quality, not quantity, or both rather, and they make up your spiritual balance at any one time. Then he said that there's some unique features, and explained how you get certain credit, seemingly credit over and above what you should have an accounting. That means you get a few free avaras. That means before they start balancing off your mitzvahs against your avaras, you get three free avaras. It's not recommended that you take those three and use them, but if you did, then three are not reckoned. Of course, the bad news is that if you don't end up on the positive side, you end up, then they count those three. You don't get them free in any case. You get them free only if you don't need them in the end. You follow? But if you end up overbalanced on the side of negative, then you've got to pay for everything. Understand it. And then he said that putting on tefillin for men is a very special one. A person who doesn't put on tefillin has got a very, very bad situation. Even at least once in his life, according to Mass authorities, according to Rambam, we discussed it. Then the Rambam said like this, and this is a very, very heavy section over here that usually drives people into a panic. In fact, the last two occasions that we discussed the subject, I had phone calls, both right afterwards and subsequently, of people saying, I'm finished. Now I've had it, I've done this and I've done that and so forth. And I was able to smile because I remember doing that myself. When I learned this the first time, I went to my Rosh Hashiva sweating and shaking with certain private, personal worries. But let's start off on the positive side, because we're going to see some heavy things together. On the positive side is the fact that a person has to know that all this, as I'm not going to emphasize, because we've all been together before, we've said this before, but just let's mention it. On the positive side is the fact that all punishment, well, let's use that word in English, it's not really correct word, punishment, but let's call it that for now. All negativity, all punishment, is only in proportion to how culpable you were. That means no one's held accountable for things they didn't and couldn't have known. Right? This is the ultimate fair system, is Torah system. Even though it may say in the Torah that this and this punishment is appropriate, or let's say consequence, is appropriate for such and such behavior, it's all modified by a deep understanding of the fact that that depends on whether you had access to the information, you didn't, whether you could have done better, whether you couldn't have, okay, ranging from an extreme of a child who's brought up without any Jewish knowledge at all, he's not held accountable for any Jewish obligations, all the way through to somebody who was brought up with Jewish knowledge, but he just wasn't given a serious attitude towards it. So he's also not accountable to a certain degree. Again, it's not something a person should rely on. But you should rely on this if the alternative is panic. We're going to panic because you think you're liable to the final and full extent of the law. For all these things, you have to be gentle with yourself and know that it's only in proportion to what you could have and should have done. You mustn't be gentle with yourself more than what's necessary, because then you won't correct your actions. You have to be strict with yourself as much as you can handle. The way I think one should sum it up, this week I had to give a talk, or last week I had to give a talk at Chabad, at the Lubavitch Shul. That's probably the hardest talk anyone ever has to give, because to inspire Lubavitchers is impossible. They're so inspired already. I don't know how you're supposed to inspire them anymore. But anyway, the point is I had to do that. And there, I mentioned to them, and I think it's a valid point a person should... I'm not insulting Chabad, you understand that? Everybody's got his part to play. I mentioned to them that a person should try and strike a balance between the Hasidic approach and the Mismagdish approach. There's a classical difference between them. Start off with just something a little bit lighter before we see the heavy things. The classical Mismagdish approach, the Lithuanian cold, the so-called cold Lithuanian logical Talmudic approach, is that a person always focuses on what he hasn't managed, what he hasn't managed to do. And you always focus on your problems, what you haven't yet achieved. You sit on your bed at night and you make cheshbon nefesh. You sit there trembling in fear, for what you didn't achieve today, and you stimulate yourself that way to try and achieve tomorrow. The Hasidic approach is you sit on your bed at night and you pat yourself on your back for what you did achieve today, and you feel happiness for what you did achieve. Now, they're both valid pathways. The one pathway is to drive yourself into a situation of fear so that you feel the fear of Hashem and you stimulate it to work on yourself out of a depth of understanding of seriousness of what life is all about. And the Hasidic approach is that, I'm not going into the historical and spiritual background, but that's just a fact for the moment, is that you must not make yourself depressed, because that's worse than any, that the worst thing you can do is make yourself depressed, because then you won't achieve anything. So on the contrary, you must make yourself happy with the feeling of what you did achieve, even though you should have achieved 100% today, you only achieved 1%. So the Lithuanian approach would be to berate yourself and feel terrible for the 99% failure. The Hasidic approach would be to get up and dance in ecstasy for the 1% that you did achieve. If you wouldn't manage to dance, then you would have some whiskey to help you. That's also... But that... It's a Pesach, a tough time for Hasidim. Anyway, the point is that you would do that in order to feel positive so that you could stimulate yourself out of simcha to do more. What approach a person should take is dependent on what your background is. If your father was a Hasid, then you should follow that line. Most of us don't have that option because we don't really have a tradition, right? Most of us, in fact, if we do, we have a Lithuanian tradition, if you can call it a tradition. We weren't really brought up that way, and our tradition is not that way. But nevertheless, you should follow. If you don't have a tradition, you could ask a question, you go where your Sherish Neshama is. That means you have a very close feeling to a certain pathway in Torah, then you could choose a pathway. If you don't yet feel knowledgeable enough to choose one or other pathway, then a person should try and strike the balance that he needs. He should try and feel genuinely upset about what you didn't achieve, and genuinely happy, really happy, about what you did, so that you can have a balance. That's what a person has to do. So, with that introduction, let's try and see the next section, which is very heavy. You are welcome to ask questions on a Sunday night. If I'm able to answer, I'll do my best. Any questions so far? Good question. I understand your question. The question, for those who didn't hear, was as follows. I just said that what you don't know, you're not held accountable for. So there's somebody sitting in the front who is a bit worried about whether she should expose herself to any more Jewish knowledge. Because the more knowledge you have, the more accountable you become. If she was sitting in the back, she'd have left. I don't think it's not. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. It's quite true that if you don't have the knowledge, you can't be held accountable. If you do, unfortunately, though, you can't escape any of your obligations that way. And the reasons are plain if you think about it logically. First of all, you know that in secular law there's a principle that you cannot plead ignorance of the law. Once you know there is a law, and you have an innate sense of a moral balance, and you know that there's such a thing as right and wrong, and you probably wouldn't be sitting here otherwise, then you can't escape by saying, well, I didn't bother to find out. On the contrary, you knew it was an obligation to find out, and on the contrary, they hold you accountable for not having found out as well. That's another avera. For the avera of not having studied what you should have, you're also held accountable. So you can't get out of it that way. There's also other ways to approach the subject, such as the fact that you'll see that a person does have an innate desire to really know as much as he can about a subject. Most people will grow to their level of responsibility. A person could stand behind the counter selling things, let's say. Why does he become a brain surgeon with more responsibility, or a test pilot, or somebody who... there's different... A person likes to rise to the level where he could handle as much as he can handle and do it well. It's a remarkable feature of the human personality. It has to be examined that, but that's what people do. And therefore, a person must rise to the level where they can handle as much as possible, and again, you're held accountable if you don't do that. The only question is this. The Rambam discusses this elsewhere, and the question that we have really is as follows. You see, what's clear is you can't avoid the responsibility of learning what you know you have to learn. The problem really, though, is somebody who's just on the borderline of that area. In other words, somebody who knows there is such a thing as Jewish knowledge, and there is such a thing as Torah, and therefore that he should find out about it, but doesn't really know that in a serious way. You follow? Let's be clear. There's a person who doesn't even know there is anything to find out. Okay? He knows nothing at all. He doesn't even know that he could know anything. So he's not held accountable at all. What would be the example? The example that the Gemara talks about is called Tino Chenishba. That's the classic example. A Jewish child who was given away to non-Jews as a baby and brought up as non-Jewish. So he can't possibly be held accountable. Nobody ever told him he was Jewish at all. There's no access at all that he could possibly have to. So he'll never be held accountable for that. The only thing is he will be held very much accountable for the principles and ideals that he espoused in life. That he'll never get away from. If he grew up as a Christian or any form of non-Jew, believing certain values, and he himself subscribed to those values, So he's going to be held accountable for if he didn't live up to his own values. That you can never get out of. Right? That a person can never get out of. A Jew, by the way, is held accountable for both. You're held accountable for things that you didn't do that Hashem wanted you to do, and for things that you believed you should have done. And you weren't true to your own values. That definitely you can't get out of, because that he'll be held accountable, but for Jewish wisdom and knowledge and obligation he won't be. On the other hand, there's this case of a person who knows everything he has to know and doesn't keep. Definitely he's held fully accountable. It's a person who's fully aware and just does not when he could have. Of course, when he couldn't have, the pressures were too great, so you're not held accountable for that. But somebody who could have and should have will be. But the Rambam discusses somebody who's on the borderline. The borderline would be, now this gets very sensitive, according to many opinions, most of us are borderline. You sitting here this evening, you've been here more than a few times, you're probably not borderline anymore. It's too late. But most Jews out there, if you want to take sort of the average, if there is such a thing, sort of more or less some total of Johannesburg Jews, probably, including Reform, because they don't know any better either. I'm not talking about the leaders. Some total of Jews out there, probably, the Rambam seems to suggest in one place that those are people, again, you can only make this calculation privately for each individual, but generally how we should regard it, the Rambam says, is something like this, that the person doesn't really know what Torah means. That means he doesn't really have an understanding that's sort of soaked into his being that he had from a child, that the whole business is really serious. You know, even if he has sort of heard about it, even if he studied it, but on the other hand, he's got a secular system that tells him that the whole thing's just an accident, he's just an evolutionary sort of monkey, and he doesn't really understand the whole thing seriously, and he thinks that they're of equal sort of thing, so he doesn't really have a serious understanding. What the Rambam means is that you can have an understanding of the details of Jewish thing, but unless your personality connects with it and takes it seriously, so now, but the problem is this, yes, but you should have investigated it more. So the Rambam says, yeah, but you didn't know that was a serious obligation even. You knew you could sort of find out, and yet, that's a very, very confusing thing. So there are different opinions. One opinion is that the person's not responsible. Another opinion is that he's fully responsible, because he had access to information that he should have. Once in his life, somewhere he was stimulated to go in and hear a shir, or take it more seriously, or challenge himself with the idea that surely life is more serious than just messing around and so forth. And therefore, he should have investigated. The Rambam seems to take a middle line. He says in one place that if you come across a person, this is what he says, if you come across a person who doesn't know about Judaism, this is the way he puts it, and therefore he doesn't observe, and you explain to him, that's what he says, you tell him, look, you know, there's this and this obligation, and the Torah says this, and you start giving him a whole story, and you prove it, and you give him a lot of detail, the Rambam says that if he still doesn't observe, he shouldn't be surprised, because you can't just give a person a lecture and expect him to really understand fully, and therefore the Rambam says you shouldn't judge such a person harshly, you should gently and kindly try and involve the person in feeling what Judaism is all about in a gentle and gradual way. That's the way he puts it. He doesn't sort of commit himself over there what will be that person's accounting in the next world. And so that should be our approach to such an individual. What will be his accounting in the next world, we understand generally, only Hashem can decide. How much access did he really have? How serious did he really take the whole thing? Only he and Hashem really know that, so we don't really know. That's the attitude we sort of take. Let's just summarize. If you don't know about Jewish obligation, but you know that there is a world out there of the information, and you've heard at least somebody that you respect somewhere along the line who doesn't seem like a brainwashed sort of a zombie, somebody who seems to present things in such a way that you could at least further examine such an individual's, the way he puts it to you, or a source, a Rambam, or some Torah source in writing, or whatever, then you clearly have an obligation to have at least investigated it at a more serious level. And if you say, I'm not going to check into this anymore because I'll become more obliged, so then you'll be held accountable for that action, and that could be a wedge, right, that accounts for many, many things you're not doing later. Don't ask me how exactly you'll be held accountable for each detail. I don't know that accounting. But you can't get away without, just like in secular terms, you can't say, well, I didn't know. I avoided studying that aspect of the law, and therefore I'm not accountable. And of course it goes in proportion. When you avoid secular knowledge of a technicality of the law, let's say in tax evasion, that you genuinely didn't know about, so they'll be more lenient with you than if you neglect some detail of the law that causes interpersonal damage and hurt immediately, because that you should have a more innate sense for, that you can't get out of. And there's a range like that in Torah too. I'll just give you one application. We'll finish with this. There's one beautiful application, which is two questions they raise in Torah. One is how the generation of the flood could have been punished when Hashem had never told them what he expected from them. The generation of the flood was long before the Torah was given. Hashem hadn't appeared to anybody at that stage, basically. So how did Hashem wipe out a whole generation when he never told them what their obligations were? And a similar question they ask is how the Jews were punished for things that they did before they really accepted the Torah. the usual form that question is phrased in, from the time Hashem appeared to them and gave them the Torah until Purim, which is when they voluntarily accepted the Torah, until then it was forced upon them. All these questions are basically the same question, and the answer we give is that the generation of the flood and non-Jews who have never been exposed to Torah knowledge at all are all held fully accountable, because they're held accountable for things that every human being should know. And basically those are seven things, and you can't get away from them. Not to kill somebody, not to steal from somebody, certain sexual immorality and various other things a person can figure out for himself, it just offends the natural human sensitivity. And that's a natural law, and you should do it because it's a natural law, as well as doing it because Hashem wants. And therefore, that kind of thing you can't get away with and say, well, I didn't know. Even in that, no doubt, there must be some level of depth of which you knew how serious it was, depending on your background, sensitivity and so forth. And again, that kind of calculation is common. That's an even better question than the previous one. The question was much tougher. In fact, that's the end of the question, sorry, tonight. The question was, what about somebody who has the knowledge but he doesn't have emunah? Emunah means the actual innate, intrinsic knowledge that the thing is true. Basically, we covered that, if you think about it. It means a person who has the knowledge but hasn't yet impinged on his personality. So you could call that the connect. What we call emunah is actually the connection with your personality that the knowledge makes. Integrating it into your personality, exactly. And therefore, if you think about it, you'll see no one's fully responsible in that way, because emunah is a lifetime of work to get any of. Very few people have any meaningful degree of emunah. That's a real, real hard effort to get any of that. You've got to reach up into the transcendent world to know something that's transcendent, to really know it. And therefore, that isn't the way it goes. Probably the way it goes, better to think about it, is this. That although you might not, let's say, an intelligent individual, somebody can think things out for himself, should be able to say to himself, I don't feel this intimately and intrinsically yet, but I'm aware intellectually that it very well may be true. It makes a lot of sense. The people who say this fit together very well. What they say makes sense. They can back it up. They can prove it at least as well as the opposite school of thought. And therefore I should suspect that it may be true, at least to the extent that I should be aware of this thing. That's a logical response, without yet connecting with him on it. So at least that far the person has to go. You follow me? That's the one thing. The other thing, again, he'll be judged by things that he didn't want others to do to him. Did you do that to others? Which is a purely mechanical judgment. There's plenty that he can be judged for before he gets to the level of emunah. Emunah he'll be judged for not having tried to reach. That's an individual, for example, an individual who lives in the world feeling that being human is something special. There are lots of people out there who've got no knowledge of religion, who really have a special feeling that there is something special to the world. They have ideals, they have principles, they have aesthetics, they have a lot of things that they will readily acknowledge a monkey doesn't have. They feel that there's something special about being a person. They've got stirrings within them of something higher. Such an individual can't get away with saying that he actually thought he was a gorilla when it's convenient. He can't do that. So he's going to have to be true to that inner sort of feeling somehow. So he can be held accountable for that. Again, these are very private things that we can't really. Can you hold that question? The Rama's going to go through 13 people who lose their place in the world to come. Yes. Just before you walked in, what I said was that... I think before you walked in, these 13 things you're going to lose your place in the world to come for, but I tried to make this lengthy introduction to show that it's only if it's appropriate to you, or what you could have known and should have known. Rambam's talking all else being equal, as Torah always does. That means these 13 things, for a person who knows what they involve, should have known better, could have done better, that we're not talking about somebody who couldn't have known better. These things don't apply to him. That's why I don't want anybody to panic, because it's easy to panic when you're... Being able to cope with. You're never held accountable for what you can't cope with. What's called Oynes Rachmona Patre. If you couldn't cope, intellectually, emotionally, circumstance-wise, really couldn't cope. Not just the cop-out. You're going to be held accountable for the cop-out. But if you really couldn't cope, so then you're definitely not held accountable at all. Then you have minimal obligations. A person who can't cope, let's say, who's not okay intellectually. Right? Who's not okay intellectually. So that person, mentally... That person has got certain obligations, not allowed to harm anybody else, with the full force of the law. All negative commandments he may not do, but he's not held accountable for positive commandments. What it means not to be okay mentally, you have to know. It's not so simple. It doesn't mean certain psychological problems. That's not good enough. One modern rabbi has got a beautiful way of looking at it. He says, how do you know if somebody's mentally... You see, the trouble is, and that's why it's worth talking about, the trouble is that modern society looks at this very, very differently from Torah. Modern society tends to think... that since the whole philosophy comes out of an evolutionary approach, which means you're not really responsible for anything in the first place. You just developed that way by accident. It's all just instincts. And therefore, anybody who's criminal, let's say, that's just a behavior mode. That his genes or his background is not, you follow. So when we're forced to, we'll put him in a prison cell just to stop him damaging society. We'll give him a colored TV over there, and we'll give him a whole, you know. And America's a classic example of where you have a situation where the punitive aspect, right, the Torah is very strict. The Torah is quite clear, that especially in a non-Jewish context. The Jewish context, it was different for various reasons. But especially in the general non-Jewish context, it was instant death with just one witness required for many, many crimes. And he had a society that didn't have too much crime when it was engaged the way the Torah should require it. I mean, very strict punishment that roots out evildoers confidently, not the way it's done today. Therefore, what does it mean that you are or not responsible intellectually? So one modern rabbinic leader puts it this way, very interesting. He says that if a person does bizarre things, it doesn't mean he's not mentally okay. Person who throws stones through people's windows all the time, right, just haphazardly, it doesn't mean he's not mentally okay. If he throws stones through his own windows, then maybe, then we can talk about it. You follow? But if he throws stones through mine, it's a very different reason. I'll tell you, I just finished out last week, my brother-in-law told me a beautiful joke. Do you mind hearing a joke? It illustrates the point beautifully. Suck up this joke, okay, because it's going to get heavy afterwards. He said that, he told me a beautiful thing. There was a man driving on a lonely road, and he had a puncture. So he got off to change, got out to change the wheel, and he put the hubcap, he put the wheel nuts. You know, the, I don't know if everybody knows, ladies, but the wheel is held on with four nuts. What? Yes, you're right, you're quite right. In case any men don't know. The wheel is held on with four nuts. Listen, there are people who don't know about this kind of thing. So the man took off the wheel nuts and he put them on the hubcap by the side of the road. And as he was changing the wheel, a car flashed past in the darkness and flipped the hubcap up and the nuts disappeared into the felt and he couldn't find them. So there's no way he could replace the wheel. So he struck off through the bushes into a distant light that he saw. It happened to be an asylum for people who are not mentally okay. So he knocked on the door of this institution to ask if somebody wanted to get in and use the phone. So after a while, a light went on in one of the rooms and a voice, one of the, let's say, residents of that institution, looked down at him and said to him, "What's the problem?" He said, "Look, I've got a problem, let me." So the man said, "Well, tell me your problem, maybe I'll be able to help you." So he said, "No, no, you can't help me. Just let me in, I want to use the phone." He said, "No, look, tell me, maybe I can solve your problem." So he said, "Look, I left the nuts from my wheel," explained to the whole thing, "by the side of the road, they disappeared into the felt." So the man said, "Look, go back to your car, take off one nut from each of the other three wheels, and put those three nuts on this wheel, and you have three nuts on every wheel, it'll be enough to get you back to town." So the man said, "What are you doing in a place like this?" Well, they came everything like it. He said, "Look, I might be crazy, but I'm not stupid." It's a very clever joker. Yeah. So you see, it depends what it means not to be mentally okay. You can't claim non-responsibility for various... Yeah. You're only held accountable. No, you're judged. I understand. This again goes back to, you can answer that question from everything we've said this evening. But there is a Torah principle, Ba'asher Husham it's called, which means you're judged according to the way you are right now. That's an axiom in Torah. And even, by the way, you know how far it goes, I'll surprise you. Even if in the spiritual world they know that you'll turn around tomorrow and become thoroughly the opposite, they pretend they don't know it. We have a source for this. It says that when Yishmael was dying, as a young boy, you remember he was dying of thirst. His mother was with him in the desert. So Hashem was going to reveal to her, to Hagar, a well of water that she could use to save his life, which is what happened. As Hashem was about to do it, it says in Midrash that the Malachim, the angel, said to Hashem, "Why are you saving this boy's life? Millions of Jews are going to die at his hand. Look what he's going to do to your people, the Arab nations. What will happen?" Hashem said, "Answer me one question. What is he now? Is he righteous or evil now?" So the Malachim said, "Right now he's a righteous individual." Hashem says, "I judge people the way they are now. What he's going to do tomorrow, we'll wait and see." You hear that? So you judge the way you are now. Amazing thing. One second, there was somebody over there. Yes, please. Phrases are not... Please sit down, you don't have to stand up. Can we just stick to the subject first, do you mind? Let's keep our questions. But let's keep to the subject of losing the next world, getting the next world, losing the next world in terms of how you're being judged. Do you mind? We can deal with that, but not today, not right now if you don't mind. I'm having enough trouble on the subject.
Yeah. Yes. Going with that is, how do we know that what the Rambam says is what it really is? Going with that question.
So I'll go with the same answer. Is that okay? Okay. Do you mind?
Okay.
You can listen to tapes where we've discussed this, the reliability of Torah tradition, and I'm very happy to come back to it again. But let's stick to one thing at a time. We'll never make any progress. Yeah.
Does a film Jew have an obligation to recur other Jews?
The question was, does a frum Jew, a Jew who observes and knows about Torah, have an obligation to bring others close and teach them? It's a complicated question. The general answer is, you very much definitely have an obligation to get to every single Jew on earth and give him the best you can. The reason is that he's your brother or sister directly, and you're fully responsible to everything, for everything that happens to him, directly responsible. And if your brother were Chas Hashem being run over, you would run out there and try and save him. And if a Jew out there is eating something he shouldn't be eating, he's going to suffer much worse pain than your little brother who's about to be run out of Chas Hashem, and therefore you have to rush out and save him. The only thing is that you have to know how to go about it practically. Right? Why you're responsible for him, we'll have to discuss another time, and how far it extends, much, much more than you can imagine. But you have to apply yourself in a practical and realistic way, so you have to know how to approach that. And then there are one or two exceptions. For example, your parents. You have no mitzvah to teach your parents and bring them close to Yiddishkeit, contrary to popular belief. The mitzvah for parents is to honor and respect and love them, and not to makarav them. The real reason you don't have an obligation is because it's impossible. To try and preach to your parents about what's right and wrong in life is just such a... The statistics, the chances of you making any impression on them by a full frontal approach like that, or just experience shows they're so slim, that's not the way you should do it. To, yes, encourage parents to get involved, you must do it by setting an example that makes them amazed at what's become of you, after they know what a slob you basically are. And by getting other people to speak to them, leaving tapes and books lying around half hidden so they'll read them when you're out, that kind of thing. But not full... But that kind of exception. But the practical... The answer to the question is, yes, you have an obligation. The practical thing, how do you go about it, is a lengthy discussion that has to be. Yeah. Are there other questions on this subject directly? Alright, let's see again the 13 things that can cause a person to lose his share in the next world. First I'll read you the list. We did this before, but I'll run through the list, and then tonight, Mr. Shem, let's try and start seeing the list. We're not going to explain the list, we're just going to mention the categories. Alright, you with me? You ready? Okay, the Rambam says like this. Ve'elu hein, these are those, she'ein lan chelek l'olam abad. These people have no share in the next world. Ela, but, nichrasin ve'oivdin, they are cut off and lost. V'nidoilin al goedel rishom, they are judged according to the greatness of negativity that they did in the world. V'chetom, and the sins that they did. Le'oilam ala'oil me'olamim. I don't know any other source in Torah where it says it three times like that. Forever and ever and ever. I did tell you before, right? You've all been here before. That you have to understand that mystically, there's no such thing as being cut off and lost forever. It refers either to certain parts of the neshama, or it refers to being lost and cut off as long as the world exists, but everything will get to its final place in the end, as I said before. I'm not going to go into that now, but it's bad enough, I promise you. Now, here they are. These are the 13 categories. Haminim, we'll just give a very rough translation. The Rambam is going to explain them in detail. Minim, let's translate it as sort of unbelievers, deniers, apostates, heretics. I don't exactly know. The English words are not adequate. We'll see on the next page. He explains more. Apikorsin. Apikorsin, again, you know, in English it's an Epicurean. Again, some kind of denier. We'll have to see technically what it means. Hakoifrim b'Torah. Those who deny the validity of the reality of Torah. Hakoifrim tzkiyas samaitim. Those who deny the concept of resurrection of the dead. Ubabiyas sagoyel. Those who deny the messianic concept. Hamoidim. Those who rebel. We'll have to see what that means also. Umachtiyei harabim. Those who cause the masses to go astray. Again, there are branches of Judaism. We referred to this last time, where the people involved in those sects, or whatever you want to call it, don't know any better, but the leaders do know better, and therefore they lose a share in the world to come. We'll see that in more detail. Perhaps we have to have a whole talk one evening about why we shouldn't be tolerant of other branches of Judaism. Not the people. People we have to be tolerant of. We'll have to try and get back to that. Haposhim midake tzibu. Those who divorce themselves from the ways of the Jewish people. And again, you have to understand that all these categories are respecting the concept of all else being equal. That means, when the Rambam says somebody who separates himself from the Jewish people, he means somebody who separates himself but all else is okay. That's not a person who does Averis. You follow? It's a person who keeps every mitzvah that he has to keep. It's not a person who does Averis. Then he would be liable for that. This is a person who keeps all the mitzvahs, does everything. The only thing he doesn't do it together with the Jewish people. He doesn't cry when they cry, and he doesn't happy when they're happy. Now that's what it means, who separates himself away. He doesn't feel part of the Jewish people. Because the Jewish people actually is our next world. And that comes back to your question. We're so intimately responsible for each other that our concept of the next world actually is going to be all of us together. Can't get away from it. Just like you wouldn't be happy in the next world as an individual without your family. So we are a family. We're going to feel very much connected to each other in one sense. And therefore somebody breaks himself away from that connection, so he's not going to be connected in the end. You have to understand more what that is. Ha'oyse avaris b'yad Rama. Somebody who does sins with a high hand, meaning, let's say flagrantly or blatantly, he goes against, he does certain sins. Sins that otherwise wouldn't give him this terrible punishment. But because he does them in that blatant way, completely disrespectful, we'll have to see details. That person can lose his share in the world to come before he has to, publicly. Kayehoyakim, he gives an example. Hamoisrim, next category, those who give over Jews to the authorities, you have to be very careful of this. The classic situation is a person who gives a Jew over, let's say, to the Romans, where the person will be killed. That would be a classical case. And in Halakha it says that even if he gives him over to the authorities, where he won't be killed, but he will be financially damaged. That means if you report the Jew to the authorities for tax evasion, let's say, even if the Jew was doing something, even if he was evading tax, we're not talking about whether he was doing right or wrong right now, but to hand a Jew over to non-Jewish authorities, it's called a moiser. If you'll get killed, certainly, and even if you'll get financially damaged. Don't ask me the halachic details of application in this generation when you're a black. Somebody came to me with a very difficult question. Two people who work in the tax. There are young people who work now, instead of army service, you can do certain governmental service. You're aware of that. Two young men came to me recently who work in the receiver revenues office, their job being to investigate people for tax purposes. And many of the people they have to investigate are Jews. And if their investigation turns up a problem, they'll put the most of these people to governmental authority, which involves the Chilul Hashem. Many, many avaris. It's a very frightening question, that. Yeah.
Just on that point, if I'm not mistaken, they say somewhere that we have to go with the Lord alone.
That's right.
How does that tie for that?
That doesn't yet mean you can hand a Jew over to authorities for not doing so. That's another problem. First of all, you have a problem that is called dinah de malchut dinah. That means that the law of the land governs a Jew. That's principle one. But that doesn't yet mean that if another Jew is not observing the law of the land, you can hand him over to be killed by the authorities. That's another problem. Okay? Even though you know he should be observing the law of the land. But just to make it a little less difficult, the law that you have to observe, the law of the country in which you live, is a limited law. That means not as long as you don't, it's as long as you don't break Torah law. If the law of the land wants you to be a Nazi, right, obviously, or wants you to do something even less extreme than that, which is a contravention of Torah law, so then obviously Torah law takes precedence. Then it becomes a question, how extreme do you have to be? Do you have to be put in jail for that? Do you have to be tortured for that? So it depends which law exactly of the Torah and which law of the land, and we have principles governing that whole area. Just a quick and easy way to relate to it would be that where the country lays down laws that have got nothing to do with Torah, tax is a very unique one. I'm not prepared to speak about that right now. Tax in various contexts and financial obligations has to be approached separately. It also, this law applies also, but you have to know how. But simple applications would be things like the social norms of the country, things like the road, the laws of the road, things like that that don't threaten your Torah observance in any way, so that you're definitely obliged to observe those kind of laws. They're much more complicated than that. But now we're dealing only with one thing, handing a Jew over to non-Jewish authority. As I mentioned last time we ran through this list, you're not even allowed to go to a non-Jewish court. Never mind hand him over. You may not go to court with a Jew. What do you do if you have to? Like, he won't accept going to a Beis Din. It's another problem. Or if you get subpoenaed or you have to go to court, that's another problem. But voluntarily, you may not take a Jew to a secular court. What's he got to say? What's a non-Jewish judge got to say about how two Jews should settle an issue according to Torah law? Despite the fact that there's a law of the land. So, that's another question.
Why is it actually accepted that people cheat on income tax and other financial things, but yet and socially accepted and regarded as morally correct? I mean, I wouldn't...
Jews, you mean?
Jews.
what, yeah.
But the Yetzirah another Jew or anybody even a non Jew or a few men that they wouldn't do that.
That's an interesting question. That's not as outlandish as you think, but I can't answer it now. Okay, and also privately it's easier. Okay. But the basis of your question, why it's socially acceptable to do certain wrong things, that we don't have to discuss. People could be socially wrong.
But you, the
yeah, there is, you're right, there is something to that, not the place now. Okay, you understand that?
Yeah.
Matila Ema Ala Tzibu Shelo L'Shem Shemaim, those who frighten the Jewish, not to make, who impose fear on the Jewish community, not for the right reason. Shofchei Damim, those who spill blood, murderers. Not bad. The Rambam's been through about 11 of them before he gets to one that you would have listed, I think. Right? I'm not sure you would have thought of these so far as being worthy of losing your share in the world to come. You would have probably started off with some kind of gross torture, murder, that kind of thing. Dig in the list, you know, but down here, Sheikh Adamim, that is somebody who's guilty of bloodshed. He loses his share in the world to come, which is very interesting. It means that things lesser than bloodshed that are not included in this list doesn't say here that you lose your share in the world to come. There's very other very extreme crimes, very extreme avarice. It doesn't say you lose your share in the world to come for them. We have to understand what exactly is behind this list. There doesn't seem to be seriousness only, unless our concept of what serious is very, very different from, you know, what we, the conventional wisdom. We'll have to study this. Next is Baalei Loshon Hora. People who speak Loshon Hora, and we promise to do a whole series on that or talk on that when we get down there. Again, it doesn't mean, just for those who are panicking already, it doesn't mean those who once occasionally say some Loshon Hora, that doesn't mean you lose your share in the world to come. It's not good. But Baalei Loshon Hora means people whose personality is given to that. It means people who routinely do that, right? They routinely bring other people down. And finally, a Moshech or Losoi. That is a man who tries to undo the bris. That means he tries to uncircumcise himself, surgically or some other way. He tries to modify himself physically so that the bris is not recognizable. We'll have to discuss this as well. Now let's see. Okay, that's the list we said before. Yeah.
What about the other two cardinals?
Not included here. Sexual immorality and idolatry is what you're referring to. It does not say here you lose your share in the world to come for that. That needs a lot of thought. We'll have to see that. Yeah. Where, what are these 13 things, in other words? Where'd you pick these 13 from? We'll have to study that. Yes. On Tuesday mornings, by the way, I just want to say this. On Tuesday mornings, we have a ladies' learning program. And there, the ladies who've been coming, we've been studying the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. And it's fascinating to know that the 13 things that he lists as principles of Judaism are these 13. And that's, one is the source for the other. We'll try and go into that when we've seen the list in more detail. Or come on Tuesday mornings. Yeah. One second. Contraception is not called spilling blood here. Abortion, again, is a very complex issue. It depends, okay? There are cases in which, let me just put it to you this way before we get carried away. There are cases when killing a human being is a mitzvah. They're not only abortion, okay? For example, if you see somebody trying to kill somebody else, all else being equal, I don't suggest you, but or with all the givens that the Torah requires, if you see someone trying to kill somebody else and there's no way to stop the assailant other than taking his life, you may do so, and it may even be an obligation. That's called roida, if it's a special halacha. So spilling blood, when the Rambam says spilling blood, killing, he means in the halachic way that fits into this category. Okay, there's many times when it's a positive mitzvah to do it. You have to know. An abortion fits into the same category. To perform an abortion to save the mother's life is an open mishnah that says it's a downright obligation. You may not even choose. Of course, today we're usually not put in that difficult medical situation because we don't have to kill the child, chas v'shalom, to save the mother. We can usually get away with much less than that. But if you do have to, that's an absolute mitzvah. But that's only while the child's unborn. When the child is halfway out of the birth canal, halfway born or more, then you're not allowed to choose the child over the mother over the child. You have to then, there's another whole principle that applies there. But while it's unborn, the mother's life takes precedence over the child. It's another whole subject. Contraception is another area, okay, which is not considered spilling blood in this way, but it's not absolutely forbidden from a Jewish point of view. Again, depending on many, many conditions. I'm not going to give you a whole talk on contraception right now. But generally speaking, we try to avoid it, generally speaking, especially until a person, a man especially, has done the... Not that a man... I'm not talking about male contraception. I'm talking about a couple who are married, either of them utilizing some form of contraception. We try to avoid until the mitzvah of having children has been done, which according to most, according to all authorities, is two children, and according to most, is a boy and a girl, which may be much more than two children. And then, according to those authorities, you only really fulfill the mitzvah. A woman doesn't have this mitzvah, by the way. A woman doesn't have the mitzvah to have children. Most authorities say because you don't have to tell her. A man's the kind of creature you've got to bash over the head with this mitzvah. A woman doesn't need to be told in order to express herself in the world. But be that as it may, and most authorities say that to have two children, you're only ready to fulfill the mitzvah when your children have children. You don't fulfill the mitzvah yet when you've had children. Only when they grow up and they have children have you fulfilled your mitzvah. Of course, not much you can do about that except educate them correctly. But nevertheless, that's the way it goes. So, but there are circumstances where the well-being of the mother, even sometimes mental well-being or strain or whatever, does provide a place for contraception. That depends, A, on whether the mitzvah has been done yet, and that is subject to discussion, and B, what form of contraception. Because there are forms of contraception that have various halachic problems on many levels. And therefore, there are ones that are more preferable than others that are less. But that's another whole discussion. You do not lose your share in the world to come for the, generally speaking, for what you said right now. But, yes, please. Yeah. He doesn't lose his share in the world to come. Excuse me? No, that's a bad mistake. One second. First of all, a Jew does that sin. He becomes a Christian, let's say. Okay? Let's just say, for argument's sake, he becomes a Christian. The Rambam doesn't list that here, as was mentioned before, even if it's outright idolatry. Let's say he becomes a worshipper of a faith where the principle, well, what they do in that faith is outright idolatry, which is one of the three cardinal sins that you have to give your life for in Judaism. Even that, it doesn't say here, you lose your share in the world to come. The Rambam says elsewhere that in order to get your share in the world to come, you need to go through certain experiences after having done a thing like that. But if you go through those experiences, like, for example, suffering and death, he explains that in the first chapter, then you haven't yet lost your share in the world to come. Going over to another faith, though, is not necessarily idolatry. If it's Islam, for example, so the halachic authorities, there were many who said that a Jew be converting to Islam, let me get it right in order, okay, let me just not mislead you. You cannot convert to another religion from a Jewish point of view. You just can't, there's no way you can be un-Jewish. You just can't undo that. There's just no way. You can call yourself whatever you like, but you're Jewish. A non-Jew can become Jewish. That he definitely can do if he does it correctly. It's not so easy, but if he does it correctly, he can be 100% Jewish. A Jew can never become un-Jewish. He can just be a Jew who sins more and more and more. And he can call himself whatever he wants, but he never can become un-Jewish. There's just no way. They can call it whatever they want to, but we just... However, a Jew practices that religion, he becomes involved in that thing and takes it seriously, so then it depends on what Averus is doing. So that's a whole discussion. Many halachic authorities ruled that for Jews to pretend to take on Islam in order to save their lives, is not necessarily forbidden because it's a monotheistic religion. So you're still believing in Hashem and you're relating to Him. So they've got a belief that you chop off a person's hand if he steals, which is wrong. Okay, so but that doesn't yet mean you have to give your life for such a belief. If you go to certain Eastern sects or other religions where there's downright definite open idolatry, you have to give your life for that. But again, you have to know the parameters. Christianity provided a big problem it's a big debate because Christianity is not outright idolatry because they do believe in Hashem. The problem is that that's one angle of the problem, and another angle is that the belief in the person that they believe in is that they make that person into what the technical definition is called shutfus. It means they give God a partner, as it were, one or two partners, whatever, but they give him a partner, which is a form of idolatry, but not the blatant form. You follow? It doesn't say here that you lose your share in the world to come for that. No. In other words, what you're obliged to give your life for and what causes you to lose your share in the world to come seem to be two totally different things. Two totally... Excuse me? Yeah. That doesn't mean he's lost his share in the world to come because a person who commits suicide... Suicide is not a good example. Being buried some... I'm not sure. The Rambam doesn't say it means he lost his share in the world to come, though.
Well, let's say it's something close to your...
Cremation is another problem. Cremation is another problem. It doesn't say you lose your share in the world to come for that either. There are certain problems with the resurrection of a person who cremates himself, but that's not. Yeah. The question is that we've listed as one of the categories somebody tries to be uncircumcised. But again, that's a specific technical problem. If the person pretends to be a member of some cult or believes he's a member of a cult, but he doesn't uncircumcise himself, so that's not what we're talking about here. On the other hand, a Jew who says he's Jewish but doesn't want to be circumcised, so that would be over here. They're not necessarily identical. Okay, let's start to see some of the details, yeah? Alright, let's start to see some of the details. There's plenty to think about over here. There's many, many hours of discussion, yes.
Can you tell us in a previous year there were two things that you'll share in the world to come. One of them was if you're not circumcised, and another part was
relations with a non-Jewish woman.
Yeah.
No, I didn't say that. What I said was this. I said that there is a midrashic statement that says the following thing, and it's worth clearing this up now. It doesn't say you lose your share in the world to come. It says this, that Avraham Avinu, that means Abraham, whatever it means in the mystical world, sits at the entrance to Gehenna. Gehenna is not, it's a place of intense suffering, okay, which is an expiation or a situation where a person feels the pain of the consequences of what they did, and that pain has some kind of cleansing effect. Right? First of all, you've got to understand that it's not a negative thing the way the world understands. On the contrary, we have examples in the Gemara of people who didn't get into Gehenna and other people davened for them that they should get into Gehenna. Because without that, you can never make it. That's terrible. To go through that which is painful, you follow. It's like going through painful surgery, but without that, you're finished, let's say. So you have to go through that in order to get corrected. It says that Acher was a man who did certain things that were so bad that when he was buried, everyone knew, he's told me, Rabbi Meir knew that he didn't get into Gehenna. So it says Rabbi Meir went and he cried, he davened to Hashem and that he should, his Rebbe should go into Gehenna, and they saw smoke coming out of his grave. Okay, so then they were happy, they knew that he got a chance like everybody else. So like it's not so, but anyway, let's just, whatever it means, you, a person going into Gehenna. It says, Avraham Avinu sits at the entrance to Gehenna and he pulls out every Jew before he goes in. Okay, so it says, he sits at the door and he pulls him out. He doesn't let you go in. He saves you. Okay? He's able to do that. There are those who say, so as Emma says, that when it says he sat, he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. Remember that pasuk? So as Emma says, it's a reference mystically to sitting at the entrance to the dimension of punishment in the real heat. And there he was trying to bring in visitors. What he's doing at the entrance to that opening is pulling out Jews. That's what it is, mystically. Anyway, but the only thing is, there are two kinds of Jew, I said, that he cannot recognize. And therefore he doesn't pull you out. He doesn't have the power or he can't recognize you. And that is a Jew who has uncircumcised himself, or a Jew who's not circumcised. Now not a Jew, again, not a Jew who's uncircumcised halakhically validly. There are valid halakhic reasons for a child not being circumcised. And it would be a terrible sin to yes do a bris on such a child. For example, a hemophiliac child, the Gemara says, not allowed to have a bris, generally speaking, because it's a danger to him. We're not talking about such a child. We're talking about one who should have and could have and knew about it, etc., etc., and deliberately didn't. That kind of person. Or, and now, I know there's going to be a string of phone calls for this one, but a Jewish man who had an intimate relationship with a non-Jewish woman, okay? That's what it says. Avraham Avinu cannot recognize such a man, and he can't pull him out. Again, before you start phoning, it means somebody who understood this issue with all that's required, and again, with all those parameters that we mentioned before. That's what I said. It doesn't say you lose your share in the world to come. It just says that you cannot be saved from that particular, right? Other people could make it even without going through that dimension. Because what does that midrash mean? Very briefly, just for those who are having trouble with it, the words are childlike words. He sits at the door, and as you go in, he pulls you out, and he can't recognize you. The basic idea that the words are trying to convey there is that what it means when we say that Avraham Avinu sits at the door of such a place means that his merit protects you. It means that he did such great things for Hashem that Hashem is prepared to show certain kindness to his descendants just because they're members of his family. Just like you would do for a friend of yours, if you respected him and loved him very much, you would be very nice to his children even long after the friend wasn't here anymore because of your loyalty and love for that friend. That's the way it goes. And therefore, we can rely on the merit of a man who is as great as that because we're his children, even if we don't really live up to his standards, but somehow we are connected to his merit. However, a Jew who behaves in such a way that he denies all connection to that family, as I tried to explain once before, so how can they recognize him? As I think I gave you an example once before, if you come up to the door of an exclusive country club and you happen to drop your name, right when the chap at the door doesn't want to let you in because you're wearing a tattered pair of Bermuda shorts and over there you need a jacket and tie, is about to have you thrown out by the bodyguards over there, you happen to drop your name, and your name happens to be the same as the person who founded the club, right, and funds the club, so then they'll let you in your tattered shorts. They won't mind about that. But if you don't drop your name over there, or you've changed your name to some other name and they can't recognize you, so they're going to treat you like a common tramp. And that's how it is. If a Jew comes to the entrance to Gehenna and he has the signs, but he's still connected and he's still proud and wants to be connected to that amazing family, so then they'll treat him like a member of the family. But if he's done the kind of things that make a connection, bris, you have to understand that why those two sins, a bris milah, which is connected to the sexual area, and a sexual contact with a non-Jew, why those two sins, why are they so bad? Because those are the things where you bond into something that's not Jewish. That's what it means. The whole concept of a bris is a covenant. It means a covenant of an intimate connection to that which is Hashem's thing in the world. And therefore, if that thing's intact, at least that thing's intact, it means the connection's to the right place. But if a person has disconnected him from that, you follow me, that's what's being implied by that measure. That happens to be for a man. What the equivalent is that for a woman, I don't know. It doesn't say the medrash over there. Listen, I wouldn't complain if I were you. Those are two problems that are met. That medrash doesn't say. I don't have the knowledge to tell you. I can't think myself from my limited store of Torah knowledge of what it says that a woman does in such a way. Definitely. It certainly says in halachic sources that when a woman has a relationship with a non-Jewish man, it's an amazingly negative thing. But again, it depends on her knowing what it meant and so forth and so on. But it doesn't say that that's the particular consequence of that particular. What it is, I really don't know. And what the equivalent is, I also don't happen to know. Yes, please. Again, it means a blemish on the neshama that takes effect in terms of the depth and degree of responsibility. Not an accidental chance happening. Person thought that the woman was Jewish, let's say. And she turned out not to be. He'll be held accountable for other things, not checking, not being careful, for being promiscuous, I don't know. But he won't be held accountable for that thing. Again, it depends on how much it actually caused that damage to the neshama. Yeah.
And you say there are ways to atone for that?
Yes. This list of things that you lose the next world for, I hope that was clear. You can atone. That's only if you die before you get a chance to fix these things up. I hope I didn't mislead you. Everything. Why? A person, let's be clear about this. I'm glad you asked this. A person who messed around with his bris, or married a non-Jewish woman, or anything else in this list, if you do tshuva before you die, absolutely wipe it out totally and completely. Absolutely. That's the good news. The bad news is, in the next chapter, the Rambam lists 24 things that you can't do tshuva for. Okay? But they aren't necessarily these things. And those are 24 categories. Each one has many subcategories of things that are impossible or very hard. There's nothing impossible, but very hard to do tshuva for. That means that some things are much harder to correct than others. That's not necessarily consonant with this, what do you call it? Doesn't overlap necessarily with this list at all. That's another subject. Some things are very hard. You can do tshuva for anything and it's valid. Absolutely anything you've done, if tshuva's done correctly, and that's the first three chapters we saw together, absolutely wipes out totally and completely what you did. That's why it's worth doing tshuva now. Every day you should do tshuva. Definitely. That's why we started with that, and that's what we're going to come back to in this. But there are things that are harder to do tshuva for. Not that there's things that block your doing tshuva. That's another discussion. Not related to these 13. We'll see that afterwards. Is that clear? Do everyone understand that? Doesn't mean you're a lost cause if you've been involved in one of these things. Otherwise, not much hope for anybody when you've been through this list. Yeah. Is that clear? Any more questions in general about the list or about the concept? That's right. You have to go to Das Torah. You have to ask a poesek. The poesek will say, what's the degree of danger over here? If the doctors will tell him that the degree of danger is X degree of danger, he'll then make a halachic decision whether that risk is permitted, because there's always some danger with a bris, at least theoretically, to operation, even for a baby. But does it stack up against the danger? And there's halachic principles. You know that when the Jews wandered in the desert for 40 years, they weren't circumcised. Can you imagine that? The Jews that received the Torah, it says that Joshua circumcised the Jewish people because traveling in the desert is a danger. It's a danger to health. It saps your strength, and it's a danger, and therefore they wandered in the desert for years without having a bris. That's true also, but there were those born in the desert, born while traveling, who it says didn't have a bris, and they were correct. On the other hand, there were certain situations where they misjudged it. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was going, traveling to Egypt, to bring out the Jewish people, and it says that he hadn't done a bris on his son. Not because he judged. You think he didn't want to do a bris on his son? Nothing would have given him greater simcha. But he judged that it was too dangerous while he was traveling. The child would have been too weak because of traveling. And it says Hashem sent a malach to kill him. Never mind that he was Moshe Rabbeinu and trying to save the Jewish people and the whole Torah depended on himself. Sent a malach to kill him. And it was only because there was a woman present, Zipporah, greater than he was in this wisdom. She took a stone, a flint, and she circumcised the child on the spot and saved her husband's life. But I mean, his life was in the balance because he misjudged that halachic issue. You have to understand that. How sharply Hashem judges great people. But that's what happened. So you have to know, and that would be the same situation. All right, we'll just finish with the story because you raised the issue. We'll have to get into the 13 categories next time. Next time, Blinele, we will not read the 13 again. We will start, okay? If there are new people, so we'll just tell them that there are 12 others, but we'll start with the first one. I'll just tell you a fascinating story. Do you want to hear a story?
Yeah.
Very fascinating story, just for 2 minutes. I've got a friend who's a Russian who came out of Russia a short time ago. Very briefly, I'll just tell you a very brief overview of his sort of fascinating story, just to show you what's going on. This chap actually came out before the wave of immigration now. It was 2.5 years ago. This story happened like 3.5 years ago, when I learned with him in Yeshiva. This chap was born in Russia to very wealthy parents. Amazing. His father was a head of a big industrial concern, even though in the communist system, but they had two maids and a chauffeur. I mean, how it works, I don't understand, but he was very privileged, okay? He was fated and privileged. He grew up very privileged within the communist system, but the whole thing, he told me, was so corrupt that when they wanted anything, so his father, the way the factory worked is whatever you wanted, the chaps from that department gave you, and whatever they needed, you gave from your department. Everybody was wealthier. Everybody, whatever they needed, you know, didn't need any money. Anyway, the point is, he grew up very privileged. And when he was about 20 or so, he decided that he wanted a bit of a challenge in life. Russia was too easy. He wanted to make his own way in the world. And he managed to get out. His parents were divorced, by the way, many years before, 14 years before his parents had got divorced, and his mother had been allowed out of Russia with a young brother, whom he hadn't seen. And the mother was living in Tel Aviv with his young brother. The brother at the time was about 17. And they hadn't seen the father for about 14 years. And the father was living in Russia with this older son who was about 20. So, it's a true story, mom, it's a detail, another person personally. So he applied to get out, and he was granted a visa. He went to America with $200. That's all. The Jewish agency gave him $200, and he arrived through Vienna, and he arrived in America with nothing. He couldn't speak a word of English. And he decided he wanted the challenge of trying to build himself up. So he went from door to door selling things, and he went through very hard times, and eventually he had to get a job. He's a trained industrial engineer. He's a qualified degree possessing industrial engineer, but he couldn't get a job in America. He didn't speak English. So he got a job as a machinist on a factory floor, working a machine. While he was working the machine, he wrote a book in Russian on how to manage the factory. And his girlfriend, he became friendly with a girl who spoke Russian and had learned a bit of English. So the girl translated the book into English, and they gave it to the manager of the factory, and they made him manager of the factory. That they made without being able to speak English. So he made enough money over there to buy himself a business concern, as it happens, making brushes. And he went from door to door selling brushes and then vacuum cleaners, one thing after another. Finally, he bought himself a share in a food chain, and he had a chain of food things, and then he became very wealthy. It was all within about 2 years. While he was working in the food thing, he had a lot of customers who had credit with him. And the customers who had the biggest credit, he noticed, were stockbrokers. So he decided to become a financial wheeler dealer. And within about another 6 months, he was a multimillionaire. Okay, his business became making bridge loans, arranging finance in a much more, what he calls, flexible way than the banks can actually do. And he became a multimillionaire. In being a multimillionaire in this thing, he had a partner. His partner was a Hasidic Jew from New York. Right? This Russian knew nothing about Judaism at all, didn't even know Bible. When I met him, he told me that he didn't even know Bible stories. That means they'd been denied, right, because literature was forbidden. He didn't know, I'm not talking about being religious, but what Jewish child, what Christian child in South Africa doesn't know the stories of the Bible? Adam and Eve, and I mean, you follow, and he was very well versed in literature. I mean, Russian literature is very rich. But basic stories of the Bible, many of them he'd never heard of. Never mind Judaism. What it meant to be Jewish, he only knew he was Jewish, that's all. He fell in with a Hasidic Jew, and they became multimillionaires. And they made a certain business decision, and they lost all their money in one day. Right? They crashed into a desperate situation overnight. And he was ready to take his life. He said that he was finished. And the Hasidic Jew with whom he worked was humming the same tune, who came into work the next day as happy as he had been the day before. So he said to him, because there's a person really on a level, this person to whom it really made no difference. So he said to him, like, how do you behave that way? So he said, well, you know, it's this faith I have. And he started explaining to him about Judaism. And he started learning. While he started learning, they built up a fortune again. And within another 6 or 8 months, they were multimillionaires again. One of the, in fact, this chap, I'm empowered to tell you that he's one of the main supporters of Awesome Ayaki Shiva, which has a multi-million dollar budget every year. In fact, I know, because the way I found out about it is, here's this young Russian, he's about, right now, when I met him there, he's about 25. He sits in jeans in the yeshiva, but when one of the big financial wheeler dealer comes in to Osamayach, he gets called in to have lunch with him, because he's one of the major financial powers. You follow this young chap up. It's an unbelievable story. Anyway, this chap got more and more knowledge about Judaism, and eventually the partner suggested to him that he go to Jerusalem, to Osamayach Yeshiva. He can afford it. Why don't you take off 18 months? This is what this chassid said to him. Go to Jerusalem for 18 months, and I'll run the business. You'll run your end of it from there. It's no problem. You'll go sit in Osamayach Yeshiva, learn a bit about Judaism. So that's what he did. He came to Yerushalayim where I met him. He sat in Osamayach. He took a penthouse. He took a penthouse in Harnov with a permanent phone connection. He used to spend 2 to 3 hours on the phone every night in New York, managing his end of the financial dealings in New York. During the day, he spent the whole day in the yeshiva learning. He spent, when I met him, was about 8 months there already. With this girl, he'd married the girl and they had a little child now, that Russian girl. He was learning in Yerushalayim. During the time that he was there, and he used to cry. When we used to learn a piece of Torah together, I remember once sitting with him privately in yeshiva and explaining a certain issue in Emunah to him. He couldn't speak to me. He got up and cried. The depth that it was an amazing thing we studied together. I mean, it was very amazing. One of the things that really opens your eyes. He was imagine a person, how many Jews who know a lot about Yiddishkeit, that's almost impossible to turn them on. He was a person who mamish knew nothing at all. But he had his eyes so open to that thing, he couldn't say anything. He just stood, he was trying to say thank you. So he stood by the side of the desk and he started crying. Amazing thing. During the time that he's in Jerusalem, he found out that you're supposed to have a bris. And he never had a bris. So he told us he wanted to have one. So the yeshiva arranged for a certain urologist over there that would do the bris. And the yeshiva turned out, and all of the yeshiva, they went and he had his bris. Right? It's a remarkable thing. At that age, takes a lot of courage. Not with a general anesthetic, but a local anesthetic. He had his bris miller. That's what happened. At the same time that he had his bris, his father got out of Russia. Right? His father got out of Russia. What happened? The father got a permit, left everything behind in Russia, and was met at the airport by his mother. His mother went to fetch his father and they got remarried. So the family got back together after 14 years. They got back together again. And the father heard that the son had a bris. He said he also wanted one. Imagine this. So the yeshiva arranged it, and they honored him very greatly. They turned out and they arranged the bris. At the bris, they named him. He didn't have a Hebrew name. They named the father, right? The rabbonim who were at the bris, they named the father. So they named him Avraham. Why? Because Avraham was a man who took a bris on himself. So when they named him, he walked out. Can you imagine? In pain, he walked out of the room and he faced the rabbonim and he started crying. He remembered that he'd been named Avraham as a child. It was so long ago that he'd last heard that, he didn't even remember it. But his grandparents still did know a lot about Yiddishkeit. He still remembered the Jewish objects in his grandparents' house. So he stood in the lounge of that, in the waiting room of that doctor, and he told the rabbani that actually that name, the mom, that actually was his name. He remembered now. God. When the young son in the Israeli army, the young brother, heard about this, he also had a bris. The young son, who was totally unconnected, had been brought up as an Israeli, the previous 14 years living in Israel. The young Israeli, speak Russian, in the Israeli army, also hadn't had a bris. So when his brother and father did it, he also had a bris. It's an amazing thing that it gives us an obligation when you hear these things. Okay.